From La Trobe to Camp Hill, Bloomsburg to Punxsutawney, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, in the wake of the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack on Israel, anti-Semitism in the United States has been on the rise, including Jewish students being attacked on the streets of Pittsburgh. Podcaster Jake Novak is here to discuss. The city of Pittsburgh is taxing and spending more than other comparable cities. Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini have details on this week's Allegheny Institute report. And Labor Day should be a celebration of worker freedom, be they union or independent contractors. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Jake Novak in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Will the Philadelphia 76ers leave the city of brotherly love to play their home games across the river in Camden, New Jersey? That could happen, as officials in the Garden State have reportedly submitted a written proposal to the NBA franchise offering hundreds of millions of dollars in tax incentives, supposedly supported by both New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy and leaders of that state's legislature. The 76ers currently play at the Wells Fargo Center in South Philly. They've been looking to build a new arena near the city's Chinatown neighborhood when their current lease expires in 2030. But that proposal has met with local opposition and bureaucratic hurdles. A recently released study on the impact of building the arena there was paid for by the 76ers and has received mixed reviews. Governor Josh Shapiro and city officials say they are confident in their ability to keep the team in town. Stay tuned. The major party presidential and vice presidential candidates might consider leasing an apartment in Penns Woods for the next couple of months. Vice President Kamala Harris spent the Labor Day holiday in Pittsburgh. Both Harris and vice presidential nominee Tim Walz returned to Pennsylvania again later in the week. Former President Donald Trump was once again at the Farm Show Arena in Harrisburg, this time for a town hall with Fox News' Sean Hannity. Trump had proposed holding a debate with Harris on Fox News, an offer the Harris campaign turned down, leading Trump to schedule the town hall. Harris has sat for just one short media interview since replacing Joe Biden at the top of the ticket in early July. Meanwhile, the exact rules regarding the rejection of mail-in ballots for failing to properly fill out the paperwork continues. The state Commonwealth Court ruled that rejecting a mail-in ballot for failing to properly date the return envelope violates the constitutional rights of the voter. State law requires proper dating, but the court deemed the requirement, quote, meaningless and inconsequential paperwork, end quote, and held that such ballots must be counted. The issue now likely will head to the state Supreme Court. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Anti-Semitism on college campuses has been on the rise since the Hamas terror attack on Israel last October and Israel's subsequent military efforts to wipe out the terrorist group. Jake Novak is a podcaster and former staffer at the Israeli consulate. He is a noted expert on Iran and the Middle East. He joins us now. Jake, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Jake, incidents of anti-Semitism, particularly on college and university campuses, are on the rise. They have been for most of the past year. Very disturbing. Students at the University of Pittsburgh assaulted simply while walking down the sidewalk. Can you talk a bit about that incident and what can be done to protect Jewish students who are on our college campuses?
Well, there's stuff to be done at the government level and stuff to be done at the personal level. The government level has all the tools at its disposal because of Donald Trump and his extension of the Title VI part of the Civil Rights Act to start punishing these universities for not doing enough to protect their Jewish students. UCLA was just slapped with a case that was actually brought privately, but the government has the right to do this without having to go to court. And of course, we're not seeing that from the Merrick Garland Biden administration, Biden-Harris administration, the Merrick Garland Justice Department, which is a shame. So hopefully that will change with an election result. But there's also things that people must do, Jewish students must do, before they go back to campus or when they're on campus. The time for hoping that other people will protect us, it's never been actually a time for that. I mean, look at your history. There's never been a good time for that. Jewish students on college campuses must get self-defense training courses. And I'm happy to say that over the summer and the late spring, thousands did. I was involved in an organization in my community to make sure that that was made available to them. And that has to continue. That has to be done more and more. But I can confidently say to anyone who thinks they're going to attack Jewish students on campuses that they ought to be aware that thousands more of them have been given self-defense training, some of it quite lethal. So if they're going to attack them physically, I hope they feel lucky because they may run into one of the people that I helped train.
Don't you find it astounding, though, that students in this day and age in the United States of America have to go to that degree just to protect their personal safety?
It's abhorrent, but it doesn't surprise me. Look where these universities have been going for so many years. They've been recruiting these kinds of agitators, not only into the student body, but more prominently into the faculty. These colleges and universities have been hiring and giving tenure to the most radical people in the country and from other countries who teach this kind of hate. And so they've been absolutely cultivating it. So I'm not surprised. I'm just disgusted. I'm disgusted by it. It's so anti-intellectual, in addition to being hateful and violent. It's also no way to learn. I mean, just even the protests. Let's say the protests weren't so violent. They were just loud and they were disruptive. Well, is that the right place to have something like that at a university? I mean, if a university wants to have a debate where all the sides can have their debate and say what they want to say about what's going on in the Middle East, wouldn't a university be a good place to do that? I don't understand where a march or an encampment even finds a place at a university. Since when is shouting and yelling and marching in an academic setting, when you have all these opportunities to actually learn and discuss it, and people who are supposedly professionals at this, since when is that a good place to actually have a march in the first place or an encampment? It doesn't make sense on any level.
Well, is that actually their goal here, Jake? If you look at it, and you're an expert on Iran, how much do we see foreign agitators involved in all these demonstrations that are popping up and have popped up at university campuses all across the country?
Well, the money is coming heavily from places like Iran. We know that. We had evidence. Even the Biden administration came out with a report explaining that. They haven't done anything, a darn thing about it, but we do know that that money is coming from there. You know, that's another thing that, I mean, there's an encouraging aspect to this. This is not the American people. The American people aren't this viciously anti-Semitic. The American people aren't interested in this kind of disruption. So money is coming from foreign countries through Qatar, through Iran, Qatar, through some shell organizations in Westchester, supposedly charities, Westchester County, that's a suburb of New York, not Westchester, PA. And that is where it's coming from. And they absolutely are employing and paying off professional agitators to infiltrate these campuses. A lot of the people that you see in these campus encampments are not students. In fact, there are even some members who used to, some people doing this who used to be members of terrorist groups themselves, active fighters, not just political people. So you're absolutely right. This is coming from foreign sources, the organized aspect of it, absolutely.
The latest tragic news out of Israel, of course, Jake, is the fact that six of the hostages, you can tell us a little bit more about how many hostages that are remaining, but six of them who were brutally murdered by Hamas here a little over a week ago. What impact do you see this as having on the plans, on the process that Israel is going through? Is this going to set back in any way their efforts to continue the effort to root out Hamas?
Well, Israel's going through the understandable anguish of this right now, and there's a lot of internal finger-pointing, as always happens whenever there's a terrible tragedy like this. People do tend to point fingers to some degree. It's been the first couple of days there were large protests, and it really wasn't about anything specific, because there has been no policy that the Israeli government that has used that has led to this at all. This is all in the Hamas terrorists. These are sadistic people. The Israelis have accepted every ceasefire offer. Hamas has rejected every single one of them. But I do think, though, that it has created a little bit more resolve. It's going to take a little bit longer for people to see it, but there's a little bit more strong resolve. As the Israeli people get over the initial mourning, they are now realizing that there is no reason to stop, no reason to try to agree to anything more, to secure the Philadelphia corridor, which is where a lot of the weapons and rockets come from, forever, never give it up, which goes into Gaza, and do what they can to root out the leadership of Hamas. I do think that that will come out very clearly in the coming days, despite this initial anguish and remorse.
We are talking with Jake Novak. You can hear his podcast, Jake's Takes on Substack. We're going to talk a little bit more about that a little later on. Also, Jake was former staffer for the Israeli consulate. He is an expert on Iran and the Middle East. It would appear, Jake, that the Biden administration has been, to say the least, not as supportive as they can. Talk for a minute, if you will, about their reaction to this tragic killing of the hostages. And overall, what do you see as the efficacy of the support that the Biden administration has given Israel here over the last several months?
I'm going to say something pretty harsh here in a moment, and I apologize in advance for people who will take it in an offensive way, but I have 4,000 years of history to back me up on this assessment. The Biden administration failed to do anything tangible to rescue or save or protect the American hostages that Hamas was holding in Gaza. And when one of them was killed, Hirsch Goldberg, and the first thing the news media asked Joe Biden about it, what did he do? He did what people who have failed for years have done, who don't want to take responsibility for things. He blamed the Jew. He blamed Netanyahu. And I know that sounds harsh. I apologize for those who take it that way. But that's exactly what this president did. And it was a very new low point. This guy Biden and this administration and the Kamala Harris campaign have sent so many new lows for anti-Semitism in this country over and over again. You in Pennsylvania saw it up front with the Harris campaign overstepping Josh Shapiro as her running mate because of anti-Semitism. That's why she did it. That was a tremendous low point. And then to have the president of the United States, who failed in his duty to blame it on the Jew, to blame it on Benjamin Netanyahu, was yet another low point. This is a very, very sad time and a very dangerous time for American Jews, which is why, again, I have to advise them to get self-defense training if they are in a state where they can get armed responsibly and legally, because this kind of stuff has a certain trajectory that we've seen for thousands of years and we know where it's going.
We keep hearing from President Biden that he is hopeful and near to a peace agreement. From your point of view, having taken a look and studied this, do you see any sort of a peace arrangement, any sort of a ceasefire as possible? And can you even really negotiate and come up with any sort of a credible agreement with people who commit the type of atrocities that we've seen from Hamas?
Well, you put your finger on it there. There is no peace deal being negotiated, by the way. It's a ceasefire deal. There's a big difference. Peace deals, you know, we're thinking Henry Kissinger, we're thinking Camp David Accords, we're thinking a peace treaty. No one's even negotiating for that. We're just negotiating supposedly for a ceasefire. And the ceasefire being that the Israelis stop going after the leaders of this terrorist group. That's not a peace agreement. A peace will come when a Palestinian leader comes one day, right now we don't have one, and from anywhere in that group, comes and says we no longer will declare war on Israel for any reason whatsoever. That's when you get a peace deal. So we're just talking about a ceasefire deal right now, and they've rejected all of them anyway. So, yes, you're right. There is no deal to be made here. And President Biden misspoke a couple of times when he talked about a peace deal. There is no peace negotiation. It's just a ceasefire deal that's being talked about. And so far, Hamas isn't accepting any of them.
The administration seems to want to not really acknowledge the role of Iran in all of this. Do you see their fine hands behind everything that's been happening here, not only with Hamas, but also with Hezbollah and all the attacks that have occurred on Israel and attacks that have been thwarted by Israel?
Oh, absolutely. This is all Iranian. This is Iranian funded. This is Iranian orchestrated. The people who committed the atrocities on October 7th, many of them were trained in Iran. So, I mean, this is an Iranian operation. And of course, it's an Iranian operation. The only thing that Iran produces, I know they have an oil industry and they have some other industries, but that's beside the point. What they really produce, what this regime has produced since 1979, is foreign terror proxy armies. That's what they do. That's all they do. Now, the good news in all of this is that when one of them goes down and Hamas is on the verge of going down, this should start a domino effect for that entire regime to fall in Iran, because this is all they do. This is like the United States basically losing the dollar. You know, because that's our calling card around the world. Their calling card around the world are these foreign proxy armies. And when one falls, the others are going to demand more than Iran can't give them. And hopefully that will set a domino effect in motion.
We have again been talking with Jake Novak. His podcast is Jake's Takes on Substack. Jake, tell us where folks can go to find you. You have a daily podcast. You have other podcasts. Where can folks find all of this?
The Substack has all these podcasts, jakenovak.substack.com. And to get the latest updates on everything I'm writing about or where I'm appearing, it's the best to go to the Twitter X feed, which is at JakeJakeNY.
Jake Novak of Jake's Takes. Jake, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The city of Pittsburgh spends more and taxes more than other comparable cities across the nation. We turn now to Eric Montardi and Alex Sodini for this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Alex Sodini, research assistant at the Allegheny Institute. We worked on a project together this summer that the listeners can go and find at our website, www.alleghenyinstitute.org, that compares Pittsburgh with the benchmark city. And this is work that we originally began 20 years ago and have updated periodically over the years. Can you give our listeners an idea what the benchmark city is and the cities that comprise it?
Of course. So when we initially started the benchmark city reports, what we were looking to do was take a number of regional hub cities, so cities that were comparable to Pittsburgh within the states they reside in. And those regional hub cities we ultimately chose were Columbus, Ohio, Charlotte, North Carolina, Omaha, Nebraska, and Salt Lake City, Utah. And then these cities of varying sizes and a couple other metrics were averaged together. And then the goal was to create the benchmark city with which to compare Pittsburgh to.
Alex, there's a bunch of variables that we've looked at in this brief. Let's start with the basic, and that's population. Can you give our listeners an idea? What is Pittsburgh's population and population growth, and how does that compare to the benchmark city?
Using 2023 census data, the population for Pittsburgh was 303,255. The benchmark city, in comparison, was 629,354. Since 2020, Pittsburgh has been relatively unchanged in terms of its population growth at about 0.1%. The benchmark city, on the other hand, has grown a bit at 2.1%.
Very interesting. So the benchmark city is about twice the size of the population and has been growing faster. And that's in other work that we've done looking at job growth and population growth, where we might have included those metro areas that cover the benchmark cities. We've seen the same, that Pittsburgh is not growing fast in population. Other regions of the country are. Let's get into the comparisons of city government and fiscal data. A lot of what's done with the benchmark city is looking at audited data. The city of Pittsburgh and all the cities that are in the benchmark produce something each year called an annual comprehensive financial report that shows everything you want to know about fiscal behavior, essentially. Can you give our listeners again an idea of how Pittsburgh's per capita revenue and spending compare to that of the benchmark city?
Absolutely. We are looking at total revenues per capita, which includes everything the city is taking in for revenue, whether that's from the state, from taxes, from fees levied, and so on. Pittsburgh total revenue per capita stands at $2,771. On the contrary, the benchmark city is only taking in $2,018 in terms of revenue per capita. Pittsburgh is also spending considerably more. Its total expenditures per capita, which includes all of the general government functions, public safety, etc., that is going to be $2,828 for Pittsburgh, while the benchmark city is at $1,999 per capita. So Pittsburgh's total revenues per capita are 37% higher compared to that of the benchmark city, while Pittsburgh's total expenditures per capita are 42% higher than that of the benchmark city. Pittsburgh's debt per capita stands at $1,656, while the benchmark city is only at $1,173. Pittsburgh, in comparison to the benchmark city, was 41% higher.
Very interesting, Alex. Thank you. Besides the city government and their fiscal data, one of the things we also wanted to focus on in this benchmark update is the role that public education plays in Pittsburgh. We know that from comparing Pittsburgh public schools to other districts in the state of Pennsylvania, that it is a very high spending district. Right now, the district has about 50% of the enrollment compared to the physical space that it has, and it's going to be possibly deliberating on closing schools and maybe closing down some school buildings in this coming school year. And that does affect the attractiveness of the city, population, population growth, population retention, and then obviously the taxes that are paid by city residents to the Pittsburgh public schools. Can you give our listeners an idea of how school revenue and and school spending compared to the benchmark city.
Much like the city metrics, we are looking at total revenue and total expenditures. So this includes everything that school is receiving in terms of revenues and everything that the school is spending on. The total revenues per student for Pittsburgh stand at $38,013 per student, while the benchmark city is at $17,592 per student. So this means that Pittsburgh was 116% higher in terms of its total revenues per student than the benchmark city. On the other hand, Pittsburgh's total expenditures per student are at $39,941. The benchmark city, on the other hand, is only spending about $18,167 per student. This equates to a 120% difference between Pittsburgh and the benchmark city.
Given that information, what type of recommendations should the city of Pittsburgh follow to be a better performing city as it compares to the benchmark city?
Of course. So the intention of this analysis in terms of the benchmark city has always been to try and create sort of a benchmark, so to speak, for the city of Pittsburgh. So what we can really see is that Pittsburgh is lagging a number of key areas. Over the course of the 20 years, Pittsburgh has constantly found itself, compared to the benchmark city, spending a lot more and taking in a lot more in revenue and taxation. The city has also found itself being pretty embracing of unions. And so we've often had a sort of overbearing public sector. All of these factors have contributed to the city of Pittsburgh having a reputation as pretty unfriendly to business. Of course, this is going to affect the city's attractiveness for jobs and investment, which of course, as you mentioned, will also impact population growth and retention. Rather than embracing policies which continue to increase government spending, which is what we have been doing for the last 20 years, and clearly we are not getting anywhere with that, we really want to make Pittsburgh an attractive destination for businesses and residents by curbing public spending, reducing some of its taxation, potentially trimming excess public employment, and overall embracing free market policies. Additionally, I would say that Pittsburgh Public Schools also is facing a number of critical issues, much like the city of Pittsburgh. Compared to the benchmark city, Pittsburgh Public Schools is spending far more per student. Pittsburgh Public Schools also continues to face challenges with extremely low academic achievement in many of its schools. Between declining enrollment numbers, low academic achievement, and overspending compared to its peers, Pittsburgh Public Schools needs a complete overhaul. One solution would be to continue to go forward with plans to close schools and school buildings. Closing schools and school buildings would be a great first step in helping reducing expenditures. Ideally, these buildings would then be able to be sold to the private sector and would then be able to return to the tax rolls.
Very good recommendations, Alex, and critically important as we move into the months where Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh Public Schools will be deliberating on their budgets for 2025, and we'll find out in a few months what that means for the taxes paid and the levels of spending that would be going into next year. For Alex Sedini, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Independent contractors are workers too, and they should be free to freelance without government interference. So says Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
This past week, we celebrated Labor Day, which was intended to be a celebration of the American worker. However, the current Biden-Harris administration has made the day a celebration of union leadership. What the current progressive leadership fails to remember is that the freedom of hardworking Americans to choose a meaningful career is what will rebuild our economy. Top-down control from the Biden-Harris administration is crippling our workforce and limiting choice, which in turn hinders economic progress. Union leaders have backed the Biden-Harris-endorsed PRO Act, which stifles economic growth. Americans for Prosperity's own Alana Bloomsack shared, "Even before learning of a major reduction in job estimates over the past year, Americans have had persistently low confidence in their economic futures. This is due to continuing inflation, but also a range of harmful new regulatory policies, including those in the labor space. Regulations undermine self-employment, workplace flexibility, and small business entrepreneurship while favoring unionization and larger businesses that can better comply with the increasing red tape. The Biden-Harris administration has increasingly tried to apply dated labor laws from the early 20th century to our dynamic 21st century economy, with damaging effects. This has a lot to do with low American confidence in the economy and millions of job openings." The payoff, of course, is that union leadership gets to create legislation that further prohibits or stifles those not paying into the Biden-Harris agenda. This is done primarily through regulations and legislation that cause so much red tape, only those with the financial backing can navigate through the artificially slanted playing field. Whether you're working a 9-to-5 job at a big company, freelancing in a creative field, as an independent contractor in construction, or starting your own business, you should be free to pursue your career on your own terms. But right now, government regulations are making that harder. There's a lot of red tape out there tying us down, making it tough to work where and how we want. Instead of helping us, the government is often getting in the way. Here's the secret that the Biden-Harris administration doesn't want you to know. Nearly 36% of working Americans identified as independent workers, up from 27% in 2016 to 2017. That's over 64 million people, more than the populations of Texas and Florida combined. In 2020, self-employed workers had nearly 31 million employees on their payrolls, according to the Pew Research Center. Finally, most independent workers wouldn't trade their freedom for a traditional job. In fact, 80% of independent contractors prefer self-employment over traditional employment. 65% of self-employed Americans feel fulfilled by their work, compared to 47% of those in traditional jobs. Unfortunately, restrictive policies such as an ABC test, which many states use to define if a worker is a contractor or an employee, hinder opportunities to independent work. In a nutshell, this policy assumes all workers are traditional employees, forcing workers to meet extremely strict criteria to classify as an independent contractor. Plenty of other regulations keep people from reaching their full potential. 1 in 5 Americans need a government occupational license to do their job, and these licenses come with a price tag. In fact, they cost the economy 1.8 million jobs and billions of dollars each year. The final days of summer are behind us, and Labor Day has come and gone. Now, with the remainder of this Congress, we ask Senator Bob Casey to act with urgency to put a stop to dangerous labor policies such as the PRO Act and unleash economic prosperity through worker freedom. Head to prosperityispossible.com to learn how you can do that. Again, that's prosperityispossible.com. This is Emily Green, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 29 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including our newest affiliate, WNTE-FM at Mansfield University in Mansfield, Pennsylvania. Welcome to our new listeners in the Mansfield area. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.